Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvetarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Tuesday, April 14th. And before I get started with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands, the Hulkumalum and Squamish speaking peoples who've been here on these lands since time immemorial. And start off today's episode with a mix of talk and a little bit of tune, but we're going to start off with some talk. So coming up next and coming up first, we have a piece coming out of Nanaimo, BC from fellow LJI local journalist Lauren McKenzie from CHLY. It's an amazing little community radio station in Nanaimo. If you haven't checked them out, maybe you should. And check out this piece that I'm about to play for all of you this morning.
This is a CHY News Update. While countries around the world work to switch from fossil fuels to green renewables, a new exhibit takes a step back and gives voices to those affected and affecting the clean energy transition. In an animated assembly, the newest exhibit at the Nanaimo Art Gallery, Canadian artist duo Richard Igby and Mary Lou Lemens examines a global boom in clean energy and the effects it has with resource extraction activities in many parts of the world. Told through hand-painted murals, short animations, and sculptural works, the exhibit shares the viewpoints of both human and nature as the world goes through a clean energy transition. The exhibit is curated by Silly Poitin. She, Icky, and Lemens met with CHY ahead of the exhibit opening. Poitin says the trio started working on this exhibit in 2019, but many of the pieces came following a research trip to Argentina.
So we worked in Argentina for a while doing research and presenting an exhibition, and we also came here last summer to Vancouver Island to kind of continue the thinking and seeing those questions and those realities from a very different perspective. And I think the show is about that. It's about always thinking of a place and its relationship to kind of global flow.
During their time in Argentina, the trio investigated lithium mining throughout the country and the devastating impacts mining has had on the environment. Lithium is a rare earth metal and a key ingredient in rechargeable batteries that is commonly used for electric vehicles. A study published by Royal Society noted mining and extraction of lithium in countries such as Argentina have been linked to water scarcity, impacting native ecosystems and birds like flamingos. Lemens says during their trip they visited western Argentina and the north of the country, where the country borders Bolivia and Chile. This region of South America is commonly known as the Lithium Triangle, and 75% of the world's lithium is produced between Bolivia, Chile, in Argentina.
And there we were interested in meeting people from communities who have been resisting multinationals that were coming to mine in their region. So this is a very special place because for over 20 years they've been resisting successfully mega mining, including Canadian companies who went there to extract gold.
According to Natural Resources Canada, in 2024, Argentina was the fifth biggest producer of lithium worldwide, ranking behind Zimbabwe, China, Chile, and Australia. Chile and Argentina rank first and third in world reserves of the rare earth mineral.
A mineral component that's in our computers, in our phones, but also very present in the batteries for electric cars. And there we met with local communities, including indigenous leaders, to see how lithium was affecting people who have been living in these very fragile ecosystems for a long time.
This exhibit comes during a global clean energy transition, where there has been an international shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources like wind and solar. Icky says when Poitin first invited the two of them to visit Argentina, He says at first he didn't understand what two Canadian artists could possibly say to a population that's been through so much and experienced so much difficulties.
A lot of the mining companies that operate in Argentina are Canadian, so we have that link. And at the same time, there was a strong push, especially in Quebec, but in other parts of Canada, for a transition from fossil fuels to greener forms of energy. So while people in the north, we felt, were feeling good about undergoing an energy transition from fossil fuels, we realized that that desire had a very strong impact, both materially, environmentally, and socially, on the people of the global south. That while we were patting our backs for driving electric cars and feeling that we're saving the environment, we were displacing whole populations.
Iki says this exhibit looks at the complexities of the transition, that while it's good to move away from fossil fuels, there is still a price to be paid in that effort. Another aspect the exhibit examines is consumerism. Fortin had this to say.
And we rarely talk about that because often when we think of consumption, a lot of people think that if you consume less, then you have a poorer life. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done at that level, that consumption is not always joyful and pleasurable, and that perhaps consuming less can be something that is really amazing and positive.
Humor is at the forefront of this exhibit. Icky says, while using a playful manner to create art was first something to bring people into their exhibits, they discovered through their careers that humor supports how they want to get their messages through to the viewer. He also says humor has historically been used as a way to undermine power.
Oppressed societies for the longest time have used humor as a way to indirectly contest the powers and the authorities that be. You can be playful and be coy, and it's very hard to like kind of pin down. And I think that humor is also a way that we try to undermine the authority of such things as graphical forms of representation, diagrams, maps, analytical tools that come from economics or management that appear so perfect, so authoritative.
Icky says they try to present their work in an open manner that showcases different perspectives and points of view to not just represent one subject position, but several.
And I think that the reason why we do this, and again, this is something that might have happened originally quite intuitively, but as we think about it more and more, it's to bring dialogue and to remind ourselves that being political is not so much all the time about voting and representation, but being political means having public discussions regarding public interest, that finally, the decisions of our society should not be dictated by the efficiency graphs presented by economists that saying that this is the way forward because this will bring us greater productivity, but that there are many decisions that a society must take based on their values.
While pieces of the exhibit feature many voices they heard in Argentina, the two artists also looked at topics of offshore wind farms and oyster farming. The exhibit continues the Nanaimo Art Gallery's inquiry for 2026. How can we live together? This is a question Lemon says they explored while working on this exhibit.
And for us, this is a question of reimagining our society and who's part of this society. Mm-hmm. Like, is this just a question of humans? Is this how we live together includes oysters, mm-hmm. wind farms, vicuñas, other animals, other beings? And it's about really thinking, in the 21st century, what kind of conception of living together do we want to create? How do we want to change from the model of the 20th century, which was all about humans? And I think that's a question that is deep down in all the works that we're showing here.
An animated assembly is now open at the Nanaimo Art Gallery. The exhibit runs downtown Nanaimo until July 12th, 2026. For CGY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Once again, that was CHLY, and their community journalist, Lauren McKenzie. Coming up next, a piece out of Prince George, BC, from our friends at CIFR Radio.
Reporting for CIFR Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. At the Civic Center in downtown Prince George, Clairvaux-Tenay, the Highway of Tears 20th Anniversary Symposium was held April 7th to 10th, 2026. The first symposium occurred in 2006. It gained attention not only from the community, but actually managed to raise national awareness on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples along Highway 16. 20 years later, people from all over the region are converging once again over the course of 4 days, each one focusing on where the movement began in 2006, where it is now in 2026, and where it's headed into the future. At the second day of the event on April 8th, we were fortunate enough to speak with BC Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief Terry Teagee and Chief Administrative Officer or Executive Director of Child and Family Services at Carrie Sicani Family Services, Mary Teagee. We bring you to that conversation at the Civic Center now. Ms. Teagee, it's a huge journey, but looking back, are you able to summarize a little of what was discussed yesterday in terms of where the movement started, and then we'll get into today's programming of where we are.
So yesterday we really talked about where we started, what the Highway of Tears and how the 2006 symposium came to be. And of course that started with when the 14-year-old Ayla Sarek Ogier went missing, and what ended up happening is that, you know, it was enough. It was just the catalyst that just said, okay, we got to do something. At the time, then Rena Zatorski was counselor of Clairvaux-Tenay Nation, and she put a challenge out and a call to all the other governments, organizations, to come forward and do something. And so we collaborated together at Carrie County Family Services, and we actually, in less than 8 weeks, we had this symposium between 800 some days and 1,000 people some days. You know, so many different levels of government. Ministers were there, deputy ministers, solicitor general, attorney general of Canada, and all the other stakeholders came together, and that's how the recommendations report came to be. In 2006, a walk had started in Prince Rupert and then culminated in Prince George to begin the 2006 Highway of Tears Symposium.
Is there anything you want to add into the past where we were moving into where we are, Terry?
Well, I think we got to recognize where we're at that time in 2006. I mean, this was a culmination of everything over the last 15, 20 years. There were many initiatives in Vancouver about missing and murdered women and girls in the downtown east side. And much of the attention, national attention, was drawn there. But then this started gaining traction in terms of the Highway of Tears, missing, murdered women and girls. I recall many stories that were brought up. And I was, you know, sharing that story with anybody who would listen, and including my wife. And then, you know, this happened with Aaliyah. And at that time, she was on council. And I just, matter of fact, I was just finishing university at the time at UNBC. Both my wife and I were UNBC students. And she put this challenge out. And I think at that time, too, as well, really calling out the ministers and the politicians, and some of them, matter of fact, came up to their credit. I suppose they were held accountable to bring forward the Solicitor General and what have you, came forward with resources and funding. And also all the other political organizations came forward to start working on this issue. You know, it ended up becoming bigger than just the Highway of Tears because it became a provincial-wide thing. Because there were many, many missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the downtown east side, right? That was really important.
Obviously, to understand the present issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples, we have to consider the past. But today's symposium theme is centered around where we are. What are you able to share about the movement's present focus? But would you like to speak to that, Mary?
Well, I think you have to realize where we're at now. Like, it has taken us 20 years to get here. The Highway of Tears recommendations report, recommendation 32, had asked for, called for an annual symposium so that we can report out on the achievement of the many recommendations. That never happened because we didn't have the committed funds, the commitment to make the change from every level of government, including the RCMP. So here we're at, finally having the symposium after 20 years and looking at where we are today. We have achieved some of the recommendations, but there's still a lot of work to do, and so there still needs to be more funding, more resources, and more personal commitment to make that fundamental change that we're all seeking, and that's just to make a better and safer world for our children.
Would you care to add anything to where we're at presently with the movement, Terry?
Well, over the last 20 years, you see parties come and go, federally and provincially, and the problem that I see in regards to Indigenous issues such as this, or any other issues, is that these parties, the first thing that they generally do is, you know, ignore First Nations rights. You know, that's the first thing to go in terms of commitments in regards to what was already committed to, perhaps by the previous administration or party. And that's a real problem. There's no consistency. There's no, as you heard before, you know, the resources brought to bear are always reneged, or the promises that were supposed to be there aren't followed through or cut. And that's always an issue. We see this not only here, but we see this nationally. The current report card in terms of implementing the National Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry, it's not there. It started out very minimally, and it's gotten even worse, I would say.
Looking at tomorrow's symposium, where we're going, you've touched on a few of these points already, but what does a foreseeable future hold in your view?
Tomorrow, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be listening to the families and to the participants of the symposium, much like we did back in 2006. In 2006, we listened to the stakeholders, we asked questions of the families, we asked questions of the government, and we asked RCMP questions, et cetera, and that's how the 33 recommendations came to be. And so tomorrow, what we're hoping to do is to look at those gaps, to look at what are the priorities now, and then to revamp and to update the Highway of Tears recommendations report, Highway of Tears recommendations report 2.0, perhaps. So that's what we're going to be doing tomorrow, is really looking forward as to what we need to do moving forward. And really, I think we're looking at some of the speakers tomorrow on the panels. It's really about a sense of hope that we want to make sure that the families and citizens of Canada have.
In terms of, you know, what you're seeing coming down the line in the foreseeable future, Mr. TG, what do you think the future holds for the movement?
Well, I think there's a real come-to moment with this provincial government in regards to, I would say, questioning the leadership and in terms of the direction they're going. Is this government, the federal government, committed to reconciliation? Are they committed to fully implementing the 261 calls to justice? You know, that's really the fundamental question. These governments and also the institutions such as the RCMP and many of the other police forces, how committed are they to not only dealing with the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but also to reconciliation, which has been identified in all these reports, which is really important. So we'll see. And like I said before, the first thing that's brushed off is Indigenous rights, it's Indigenous issues that many of these parties tend to do when it suits them. That's untenable. Difficult to work with. And I certainly hope in the future that there's a solid commitment from these governments.
If you'd like to speak to that as well, Mary, but what do you think the litmus test would be to see if indeed the governments, the powers that be, are taking this issue seriously?
I think there has to be committed funding, certainly, and what I would like to see nationally is actually Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Act, much like they have in the States. They have the Violence Against Women Act, which was, of course, brought forward by Joe Biden, reauthorized by Joe Biden, and that act ensures that there's funding there for those preventative programs, the awareness, the safety programs. We need to do the same in Canada, and I think for me that would be the litmus test that, yes, absolutely, we take this seriously. We take it so seriously that we are going to put it into law to make sure that every Indigenous woman and girl, LGBTQIA+, is safe. And until that day happens, we're going to keep, we're just going to keep perpetuating the same cycle of, you know, stop, start, stop, start. And we can't have that. We need committed funding, committed resources, and commitment of mind and commitment of heart by politicians.
So obviously, we'd like to get to a future where these symposiums are no longer necessary because Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people are no longer disappearing. But What can the community do to strengthen the work this community does here regionally, locally? Writing to MLAs, MPs, other actions individuals or organizations can take. Would you care to speak to that one first, Terry?
Well, I think we've seen this other places, the city of Vancouver adopting the declaration as part of their policy and law. I think we can't deviate from that. And what we're seeing here is terrible, what this premier is saying in regards to pausing DRIPA or repealing it or making amendments. That's probably the fundamental issue here in regards, because DRIPA was utilized to change the narrative and to really bring all First Nations and Indigenous peoples up to a level playing field. And if we can't do that, it's obviously we see the detriments of that, high risk of our Indigenous peoples in regards to stuck in vulnerable places. And DRIPA is really important. We just recently had a women's conference in Kelowna, and one of the biggest issues that we're trying to prevent, and a lot of the recommendations, if you recognize, it's about prevention. We've seen Bill C-5, the One Canada Act, 14 and 15, to advance projects, to approve them. And the problem there, these are big mega projects and potential to put women at risk, with man camps. And we've seen examples from Tahltan, Squamish, and also Tsilcoton, to put it in their policy to highlight and to prevent Indigenous women from becoming vulnerable and putting really policy into place to address the issues of man camps. So it's really important, because quite simply this changes the whole narrative, right? It changes in regards to how companies conduct themselves. I think if we can do that on a wider level, on a wider scale, we're still seeing many Indigenous peoples just in general are more vulnerable. We see the vast majority of our Indigenous peoples, about 60-70% are Indigenous here in Prince George that are homeless. The vast majority that are dying 6 or 7 times the normal rate. If you're Indigenous women, it's 11 times. So, these different issues which really affect our Indigenous women and girls, we need to do something about it in regards to making sure that there are policies, laws to prevent it from happening and do something about it. This is a microcosm of general society. We're trying to change a culture within the RCMP, within politics, but I think it's trying to change a narrative as well, if you really think about it, of this relationship within First Nations, Indigenous peoples in this country.
Do you have anything to add to that, Mary? Or
I think the one thing, what has to change in society is that we need to understand the root causes of this. These are systemic issues. That's what causes the vulnerability of Indigenous women and girls, LGBTQIA+. Because of the impacts of residential school and the impacts of colonization, we have to deal with those root causes. And if we don't, we're going to keep having to deal with the issues of vulnerability. And I think so it is a combined, concerted effort by every level of health services, of social services, and every level of government. I was really pleased to see that there are a lot of MPs and MLAs that showed up yesterday and today. Some of them are going to stay right till the end. They're going to stay here till Friday for the pillar raising. So that's a good thing. But certainly citizens can demand better from their MLAs and MPs, and if that takes writing letters or meeting with them and always bringing this up forward, we would definitely appreciate that, because this is not an Indigenous problem, it's a Canadian problem.
We've got one thing to look forward to as a capstone, is the unveiling of the pillar tomorrow. Is there anything other of you'd like to add about that pillar?
Well, the pillar, really, the idea came to have a commemorative marker for the families of the victims. So in our way, like Indigenous ways, many of us, when we lose a lost loved one, a year after is when we raise either a totem pole or we raise the headstone. And if you don't have your loved one's remains, you can't do that. So it's really symbolic and ceremonial to have a pillar that recognizes that place where they can go, the place that's just for them. And it's also as a marker and a reminder of what we're dealing with in this country. So the pillar is going to be placed by the river. The river is healing for us. And we're just hoping that this is a real symbol of hope and of healing.
The symposium's closing event is occurring Friday, April 10th at Cottonwood Island Park in Prince George, Clayton-Tenay, where the Pillar of Hope will be unveiled between 9:30 a.m. and 2 p.m. You've heard remarks from Chief Administrative Officer or Executive Director of Child and Family Services at Carrier-Sicani Family Services, Mary Teegee, alongside BC Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief, Terry Teegee, at the Highway of Tears 20th Anniversary Symposium at the Civic Center in downtown Prince George, Clayley-Tenay, Wednesday, April 8th, 2026. Both pivotal community figures working towards solutions on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
Once again, you're tuned in to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much to CIFA Radio and Ian Gregg for that really, really important piece. Thank you for going as in-depth as you did. And to go on to the next piece, we're going to be bringing it back to the local. Very local, actually, because this piece takes place at SFU. I believe it was played yesterday morning during Magnus's Speak Up, but I thought I'd play it again because since yesterday morning, it seems to have taken a bit of a life of its own. This is a piece I produced late last week on Friday about a rally that took place at SFU in support of the Burnaby Mountain Gondola Project, which, although has been sort of agreed upon, doesn't have a specific plan set in place to build it. And there are many reasons for that, many of which are discussed in the piece. But someone took it upon themselves to post it on the Vancouver subreddit. And that is something that has not happened often for the pieces that we produce. But honestly, I'm not sure if any single commenter actually listened to the piece. But there were a lot of comments and a lot of discourse around whether this gondola should be built. So clearly, it is something that people are quite passionate about. And it's something that a lot of people feel strongly about. So I thought I would play that piece once more for all of you. Take a listen. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Outside of Simon Fraser University's Student Union building, a rally took place to advocate for a project that has long been discussed, the Burnaby Mountain Gondola. The rally was a collaboration between the Simon Fraser Student Society and local transit advocacy group Movement YVR. It was in 2014 when the TransLink Mayor's Council developed a 10-year vision for Metro Vancouver transit and transportation that highlighted the need for a high-capacity connection from Burnaby Mountain to a nearby SkyTrain station. Simon Fraser University's location on Burnaby Mountain has made it difficult to access for many, especially during snowy conditions in the winter, where it's common for buses to struggle to drive up the mountain. The Burnaby Mountain Gondola Project has been a topic of major discussion among the SFU and Greater Burnaby communities for over a decade, and students gathered to express not only their support for the project, but their frustrations around the time it's taken for its construction to start. At the rally, we spoke with Dennis Agar, Executive Director of Movement YVR, and asked him why his organization decided to join the Simon Fraser Student Society for this rally.
We're here to let the province know that we want a gondola to SFU. It's very rare that we get the opportunity to save people like 40 minutes in their day, right? Like the bus is like around a half hour plus, depending on how long you're waiting. The gondola will be 6 minutes and it will be just always coming. Like there's going to be no wait time. It's a remarkable time savings for people that have to do mega commutes into SFU. You know, it's so expensive to find housing near campus. And on top of that, now it's so much more expensive to drive with the price of gas exploding. And so we need relief. We need the government to take action, do what it can do to make life more affordable for SFU students.
Burnaby City Councilor Daniel Tatro was also in attendance to express his support for the gondola project.
I've experienced what it's like firsthand being a former SFU student to take the R5, or what I think it was.